Welcome to another Baseball America podcast. Along with JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Boy, it's been a while, JJ, since we podcasted together. I don't know what happened. The draft happened.
You know, I'm doing the JJ and the Bear, and you're doing you and Clint. We've gone on. We're interacting with separate people. And
if somebody wants to do a JJ and the Bear podcast theme song for when JJ and Josh Norris, because they do ride the rails, or they ride the roads of North Carolina, the Southeast, going to minor league games, and Josh does not like being compared to a chimpanzee, but he certainly does enjoy the Bear nickname, so that would be cool. We would encourage reader participation in the podcast.
Speaking of participation, thank you again to Connor Glassy for our very cool intro.
Absolutely. Listener and alumnus, Connor Glassy. And we also want people to not forget that it's draft season, so don't forget Baseball America's draft offer. Subscribe now and receive one extra month of access with any premium content subscription. Go to baseballamerica.com/subscribe to partake in Baseball America's draft order. But JJ, we're taking a little break from the draft because they're all related. They all tie in. But every scout you talk to, amateur side, pro side, and a lot of them are doing, especially the pro guys, a lot of them, I'm sure, are doing a little bit of both. They're checking in. They're cross-checking. They're going to the next coming weeks with conference tournaments going on. This is what everyone's talking about in baseball, JJ, is this proliferation, I suppose you would say, of arm injuries. And we've talked about it a lot. We've got a couple stories going in the next issue of the magazine. I guess, first off, are there more Tommy John surgeries in your mind? Can we document that there are more young pitchers, especially, going down with arm injuries now than maybe there were a couple years ago? Or are there just more high-profile arms getting hurt now?
Yes, there are more. Three of the last 4 years that we have seen. Now, this year we're not done yet, but we're already ahead of pace of a down year. Like, we're already at, if no one else in the big leagues got cut on from now to, for Tommy John, from now to the end of the year, it would be a quote normal year. And I hate to break it to you.
Really? More, is that drastic?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, wow.
We both have talked to a number of people. I've tried to talk to a number of doctors and team, trainers and all about this. And as one made the point to say, we had an uptick 3 years ago. The year after that, we didn't. And we go, okay.
So you hope that's a blip.
Hope that's a blip. Last year was another uptick. Okay, you hope it's two blips. When you got three blips in 4 years, it's not a blip anymore.
Now it looks like 2011's the blip.
Yes.
On the trend being up.
Yes. And I've had people ask the questions of, are people, getting Tommy John that didn't need it before or not, would opt not to? And I think that's no. I'm not saying that there aren't. I'll do a little PSA here. If you are a high school parent, I've talked to doctors who say that they have parents and high school athletes who come in and say, hey, I want Tommy John, because they think that it'll make their ligament stronger, that they'll throw harder, all that. No. Go away.
Even though we're in an information age, JJ, it seemed like there was so much misinformation. I'm not going to stick to baseball and not politics, but there's so much misinformation in today's world. It's very easy to be led in the wrong path because there's just as much wrong, if not more, than there is right.
You will not talk to a reputable doctor who will perform a Tommy John on a healthy elbow. It's not a good thing to do. For one, do remember, everyone likes to think of this, and we've talked about this on the podcast many a time. This is not a 100% guaranteed you are going to be back to where you were.
Yeah.
It is a high likelihood. The numbers are somewhere between 8 and 9 out of every 10 professional pitchers who undergoes Tommy John should return to the
previous levels. Basically.
Right.
Levels of performance, the previous level of stuff.
But that means there are guys. I mean, the example, I hate to keep using him, but John Lamb was one of the best pitching prospects in baseball.
Yeah, he was.
John Lamb had Tommy John. John Lamb post Tommy John is a fringe prospect at best because his velo did not come back. You go to the high school level, the success rate on this paper just came out on this, looked at this. The success rate on is lower. It's more like 7 to 8 of every 10 guys.
And you just said 8 to 9 for the
price. Right, so it's less. Now, there are some, with all these studies, you then say, okay, well, there's a lot of reasons for that. One may be that some guys say, I'm not going through this, and they give up on the sport. Like, if you weren't going to be a professional baseball player and you're a junior pitcher and you blew out your arm, you may say, I'm not going to go to college to pitch. Why would I go through all this? Or you could be a guy who does go through it, and you don't have the pro or the college rehab program, and you don't make it back from it.
You just don't have the level of facilities, trainer, all those kind of things. It's just very difficult. That might be accessible for some guys, but not for all.
If you want an idea of how the pro pitcher goes through, Dirk Hayhurst's new book did a really good job because he went through. You know, it's talking about him going through rehab. It wasn't a shoulder of him, if I remember right, not Tommy John, but he's going through the rehab. If you're a pro pitcher, he spent time in Birmingham, you know, working on this and rehab and all that. It's like, hey, let's send you to the best place we can to get you back. And that's nothing. It's Dirk.
That's all you do. That's your job. That's his job.
That's your job.
He was getting paid to rehab, which in high school, if you're an amateur, yeah, you're doing that, but you're also going to class and you're doing all the other things that you do when you're an amateur.
Right.
And you aren't in total control of your schedule when you're an amateur like you are when you're a professional and you're being paid to do nothing but rehab. And that's really, correct me if I'm wrong, the rehab is why pitchers think that they, or parents
right.
think they get better or you might throw harder. Because the rehab basically gets you in shape a lot of times, in better shape than you were before, number one. And number two, you basically have to relearn how to pitch.
And your mechanics.
Might get rid of some bad habits mechanically or delivery-wise.
And there is a third thing, which is that a lot of times what will happen is that, yes, if you compare... another trainer put it to me, 50% in his, he did a study, 50% of Tommy John injuries, when you ask the pitcher, it's an acute injury. 50% of the time, they feel fine, they throw a pitch, something they feel pops, they're done.
There's basically a trauma.
Right.
There's a moment, you hear the pop, those kind of things.
That's one out of every two. The other one of every two is a guy who it's a steady, wow, my elbow hurts. It gets worse. It's not that they had a clean, like, it's a ligament. It's not, in those cases, it's not something where they had a clean break. It's something where it was torn, it's more torn, and eventually...
It might heal a little bit, but never back to full.
Right, you're going to just keep pitching. When you say heal, it's not going to reattach itself.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
You're going to keep, you can keep pitching with it in those cases sometimes. But you're probably not going to have the same effectiveness, and eventually you're effectively going to have the surgery. But in those cases, if you've got a non-acute one, and you say, "Wow, I was throwing 91 before the surgery, and now I'm throwing 93," well, if you were pitching with a partially torn ligament before the surgery,
exactly.
You weren't fully healthy, and so if you combine the rehab program, improved mechanics, and now a strong ligament, and you didn't have that, well, yes, you may throw harder.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, like, that this is something where this isn't, well, you know, this isn't like popping a drug and saying, you know, I'm better. It's all those factors go into it. But again, this is something, if you have to have Tommy John, in some way, if you're not a 38-year-old pitcher, if you're Nolan Ryan,
yeah.
And as at 45,
John Smoltz.
If at 45, Nolan Ryan, your ligament pops, you pat the ligament on the head and say, "Well done, sir."
That's right.
You know, you handled 200 pitch outings, you handled 100 miles an hour for 20 years, great job. But if you're doing this, if you're talking about Tommy John and you're 22, you're 23, you're 18, in some way, we've failed as a, you know, baseball has failed. We don't want to see 23-year-old Tommy Johns.
No, and we don't want to see, the interviewers don't want to see 20-year-old Tommy Johns.
Or 18.
Or 21. But we just had a couple this month, in the last 2 weeks, you know, basically right before JJ, right as our first part of our draft preview is going to press, three of the top college starters, Brandon Finnegan, Jeff Hoffman, Eric Fetty, missed starts. And Aaron Fitt and Clint Longenecker and I are kind of heading up our draft coverage this year. Got our meeting in the conference room, and we're like, odds are one of these three guys is probably going to get cut on. And we were low. You know,
two of three.
Now Finnegan returned a pitch 4 innings last night. I just talked to one scout and texted another who are in Dallas today. And why are they in Dallas? Because they're there to see Brandon Finnegan, and everybody wants to see. You know, he threw 4 innings last weekend. Is Brandon Finnegan okay? You know, so the draft has been impacted. It seems like every year there's an injury or two with college pitchers, but you know. 5 years ago, it was Tanner Shepherds, and it was like turned out to be what a back, I believe it was with Tanner Shepherds, and then Kyle Gibson the next year, and Kyle Gibson was more of a, it was forearm, and you probably knew he was going to have Tommy John surgery. He did, and before that, it was Andrew Brackman, you knew he was going to have Tommy John surgery, and plus he was 6'11" and never a full time baseball player. The first time he was ever a full time baseball player, his elbow blew out. So you have all these different cases, but this is two of the prominent guys. I think, so there's a couple directions we could go here, JJ. One of them is that Eric Fetty and Jeff Hoffman, there's been all this talk about pitch counts. Last night, we're recording this on Thursday morning, last night there was all this Twitter hullabaloo over a high school pitcher at a 1A school in Washington State who threw 194 pitches. And it should. That is bad. You know, I'm not spinning it good or bad. I do think two things that made me think of. First of all, Pro Scout made a great point. That hasn't changed. That factor, so we're trying to find out why more injuries. So the point of a lot of the discussion in the industry is why are there more injuries? Why are we seeing this 3 out of 4 years, this rising tide of elbow injuries? And first off, that kind of usage at the amateur level, that is not new and that has not changed. And if anything, it's gotten better. And now we're starting to see, JJ, thanks to some of your research, there's a lot of evidence that that is getting better at the college level, because we went looking through the pitch counts of Fetty and Hoffman, as we've done for Carlos Rodon, and as we've also done for some Japanese pitchers who are the same age, 20 and 21-year-olds, as these college guys the last 2 years. And JJ, you've got some data, and we'll present the full findings in the print edition of the magazine next week online, but it sounds like pitch count trends in college, the pitch count trends at the college level aren't the same as they are in the major leagues, and then certainly not in the minor leagues, but they're trending more in that direction.
They are, and I think the one of the points of the story is going to be is that there's a lot we do not know. When you talk about pitch counts on a 7-day rotation, the data, there's just not much data out there compared to everything. In essence, most everything we know or we think we know about pitch counts is research largely done at the major league level.
Right.
Because that's the one area where we have a whole lot of data. You know, we have years of data. This is how many pitches, all that. You even go to the minor league level and you have it at the AAA level. You go down to low A and it is extremely hit or miss as far as public data. Now, if you tell me that every team knows how many pitch that their pitchers throw, absolutely. But if you ask me, okay, do you know how many pitches, if you're the Nationals, do you know how many pitches that the Padres pitchers in low A throw? You probably don't.
Right.
Because that data is just not there. You go to the college level, and it gets more difficult. You can piece some together, but there's going to be holes in your info. You go to the high school and the showcase level and throw out the, you know, it just doesn't exist.
It does not exist.
And so, but... the 190 whatever pitches, my question with something like that is, we've kind of, and I'm not defending that either. That's bad. That's bad. There's no, but I do have the question. Okay. It was a pitcher at a 1A school. I guess my question is, and I don't know the answer to this. Is this a promising junior who has a college career ahead of him?
Yeah,
or is it? Or is it a senior who's pitching potentially his last game and will never pitch again? Because
I'll use the example I like to use for this, JJ, is in 2009, we had the Austin Wood thing in the Texas-Boston College game. So first of all, this game was the longest playoff game in NCAA Division I history, so it's 25 innings. So it's an exceptional happening. It is the exception. It's the definition of that word. It was an exception. It was a great game for everybody who's there. It was this battle of wills. Third of all, he had all this attention on Austin Wood, and Austin Wood threw 181 pitches, and that was bad. and Keith Law of ESPN spearheaded the Austin Wood was abused. Ollie Garrido should be fired. He wasn't the only person who wrote it, but he wrote it. You know, kudos to Keith. He's never shy about his opinions, and he puts his name with it, and everyone knows where to find him. So I disagreed with that take at the time. I talked about this with Keith the next year at Tournament of Stars. And, you know, the guy threw 181 pitches, and there's nothing good about that from a workload perspective.
Especially because he was a reliever.
He was a reliever, number one, although he'd started early in his career.
Yeah, he was stretched out.
But still,
yeah.
The point is, no one's prepared to throw 181 pitches.
Right.
You know, no one in this country.
No.
You know, let's correct that. No one in this country is prepared to throw 181
LeVon
pitches.
Hernandez is somewhere around like, I may be 45, but hey, I'm still prepped. I can do it right now.
No one born in this country. We're narrowing down. Few people are prepared to throw 181 pitches. But I think what a lot of the critics of these things never take into account is I always believe with Austin Wood. So there's two parts of this. Number one, I always believe Austin Wood. It mattered more for Austin Wood to pitch in the College World Series with the Texas Longhorns, which he did in that team wound up in the College World Series championship finals and lost to LSU. But he almost, with that act of heroism, basically, which is one way you can view it, he almost won a national championship for his team. He was a college senior, and he was a fifth-round pitcher. He was a prospect, but he was not an elite prospect. And in my mind, I've said this many times, Austin Wood dreamt of, when he dreamed about playing baseball, he dreamed of doing it in burnt orange and white. He didn't dream of doing it in a Pittsburgh Pirates uniform, not to mention a State College Spikes uniform or whoever their farm teams were at that time. So I don't feel like that's ever taken into account. I'm not talking about with this specific pitcher, but I feel the real issue was actually the column that I wrote after that, which was that Mike Belfiore was a supplemental first-round pick, and he was a dude, the pitcher for Boston College. He threw 129 pitches in that game. His career high to that point was 85, so he was extended well beyond it. He was a prospect. No, by the way, when he got done pitching, he got put in left field. He joked about having to Manny Ramirez the ball back into the infield. That was the problem. That was the bigger problem. It's easy to point to Austin Wood, but I do think it's different. All these guys are not future pros. And so what they do as an amateur cannot only be seen through the prism of their future big league earning potential, because that's a small, small fraction of the population.
I actually was talking about this with someone. And again, we're not saying guys should go out and throw 108, you know. But in Austin Wood's case, financially, I don't think this, he wasn't thinking of this when he was on the mound, but financially, for his long-term financial success, he may have made more money by throwing that and doing that heroic, you know, basically in being a hero for Longhorn fans.
Calculate the amount of beer that he will not have to buy the rest of his life.
But I don't know what his career, but if you want to be, I know guys.
It hurt his career and it hurt Belfiore's.
No,
Belfiore got hurt as a pro. Wood's already been released.
Right. But what I'm saying is I don't know what his long-term career plans are, but if he wants to be an insurance agent or something like that in Texas, you get in the door. I know stories like this. David Green, who was a quarterback at University of Georgia. I'm a University of Georgia grad. He's an insurance agent now. I'm sure he does quite fine.
He was the big left-handed quarterback, right?
Yeah, he was a quarterback who had a really good SEC career and was a backup for a couple of years in the NFL. David Green's long-term career is basically he may be a great insurance agent, but really what gets him in the door, like, there are many houses around Athens and all where if you're David Green, you will make that sale because, like, David Green sells me my insurance.
That's right.
And again, that's a minor thing. But again, when I go back to the 192, if I'm a high school senior and this is my last game, I'm happy. I mean, it sounds silly, and maybe we shouldn't. Maybe it's big. No, maybe I'm wrong on this. It's not my kid, so but I'd be happy to leave my arm out there for my last game in a playoff type situation to try to win something. And
that's right, to try to win something.
I knew when I was covering high schools, there were two guys on a basketball team, two seniors on a basketball team I covered, who both had torn their ACLs. They were seniors.
Those things have value.
And they said, you know what? This is it. There were 6'1", 6'2" seniors. You know, they didn't have basketball scholarship down the road. They said, you can have the surgery now, you can have it later. You're not going to pop it worse.
Right.
We can brace it up and you can try to gut through the pain. And they're like, you know what? This is our last year. Let's do that. Again, that's not saying, hey, all these guys should be locked, but we do have to look at the perspective of there's a difference between the pro perspective rightfully is that the pro scout argument, the amateur scout argument to a guy who's in high school deciding to go to college or pro, his argument he can make is, look, if you come sign with me, we are going to do, there is not going to be a situation from age 18 to 21, 22, at least, where in any way, anything of winning right now is going to take precedence over what we see as the best for your long-term future.
Right.
Now, that shifts. You get to the big leagues. No one decries that Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling pretty much in, you know, for the Diamondbacks in, was it
01? 2001.
Yeah, in 01, they were putting, but no one would, everyone kind of understands, okay, they may have been putting their long-term health on the line to win a title there, but at that age, it's like, okay, is it worth us doing that? Well, absolutely. I understand there's a sliding scale on that. That's their argument they can make. The college coach can make the argument, you come to us and the games actually do mean something.
Right.
That if you win an Omaha.
Put it very well the other day, JJ. He just said, like, the guys in the minor leagues don't know how to make a pitch when they have to make a pitch because they're out after 75 pitches. They're out after 80 pitches. They're out after 90 pitches. I've learned how to make a pitch on that 120th pitch when I need to make a pitch. And guess what? You need to do that when you're in the big leagues. And Carlos Lordan says, I've learned how to do that. And he's learned it against different competition, but I respect that. Now, that said, I do think it'll be better. I do think long-term, JJ, high school pitchers should not be allowed to throw 194 pitches.
No, I think there should be. At the high school level, I think there should be rules.
And I don't think Austin Wood should have been allowed to throw 181 pitches. I do think the bottom line is that push comes to shove, Major League Baseball needs to be more involved in amateur sports in baseball. And one of the things that we've talked about with this injury trend is, as usual, MLB points the finger at anything but itself. That is what major league teams do. That's what executives do. That's what scouts do. They always point the finger at amateur baseball. In this case, not without merit, because 194 pitches really is indefensible, although we just spent a few minutes defending it. I think we've spent a few minutes explaining it.
We're not defending it. We're just saying it's not as black and white in that, exactly. Like, I want perspective on all of these.
Respect the fact that these guys are competitors and that what they're competing for matters to them. That is,
again,
that's all
and the thing about it is that, again, this scale, to me, the younger the pitcher, the more you need hard and fast rules.
Like Jace Fry for Oregon State, the fact that he threw 288, the disputed amount of pitches, between 259 and 288 pitches in a 10-day span at age 12 in a little league regional, there's zero.
That's black and white.
That's black and white. There's zero justification for that, except for the fact that they did pitch in the Little League World Series. The coach needs to be in there, like, come on.
But again, my personal opinion on that is the sliding scale is, as a 12-year-old, you have no clue whether you are basically derailing a future big league career. Even at age 18, we have some idea of, okay, you know, again, does the guy throw 90? Maybe I'm making too much justification. Does the guy throw 90 or throw 75? If he throws 75, okay.
Hey, if he's Submarine and if he's David Berg, pitch him every day.
Right. Well, I'm not saying even that you're not risking an injury. What I'm saying is then it does become a little bit more of, okay, well, what injury are we risking? I have a friend of mine on my softball team who was a baseball player, you know, as long as he could. He blew out his arm. He had one throw in his arm. You know, he was Carlos Clinton. He had one throw in his arm in softball. But you
Carlos
know what?
Clinton 2003 for the context for people who don't
remember. Yeah, sad. Our shorthand is pretty insane.
Carlos Clinton 2003 in the Cobble series, he had one good throw in him per game. And when he had used that throw up, Jed Lowry was the deepest cutoff guy you ever saw, and Sam Fold sprinted to right field.
Well,
and Carlos would underhand the ball.
Well, Brendan McDonald on my softball team, he listens, I think, to the podcast, so I'll give him the shout out. He was the same way. He had one throw from the outfield every game, and after that, I would run out, and he would just kind of give me the ball, and I would throw it. That was fine, because you know what? If you asked him, yeah, okay, my arm, I blew it out. His baseball career was done at that point, and it didn't affect him in any other part of his day.
Exactly.
So he's like, no, I'll take that trait. And again, we're not It's just saying there is more gray.
It's not black and white. But I do think it would be good, JJ, for Major League Baseball to involve itself at the amateur level. First off, there's a lot of talk about travel ball. I mean, JJ, you think Major League Baseball could enforce a ban, not a ban, but a restriction under the 30 clubs to say, hey, don't go to any showcases in the months of October, November, December, January, because we want to, I don't think you can say January, but you can say October, November, December. We're going to have a 3-month closed period for professional team scouting because we want to stop helping fund these showcases that make money by having these year-round events for pitchers that is going to, that cumulatively, maybe very well-intentioned, but cumulatively we now have a year-round calendar and we feel like that's affecting the health of our pitchers long-term. Do you think Major League Baseball could enforce something like that with its 30 clubs?
Oh, sure. Like, I mean, I don't know if that would have to be collectively bargained or not, but, I mean, if you said, could Major League Baseball do it?
I think one club would say, hey, you know, there's a showcase in October. Say, you know, just picking out one showcase. Say that Perfect Game did not move. It's a showcase in Jupiter, which is at the end of October. Say they didn't react to that by moving that showcase into September. Say they still had it in October. And if you're a Major League club, are you gonna go in there and break that ban, pay whatever fine it might be, if there are penalties? There probably wouldn't be any penalties, man. How would you penalize a club that broke that? How would you enforce that ban?
Well,
and would clubs just try to mutually say, we're not going to do this because we want the long-term health of our arms? Or would you try to get that advantage by going in and scouting those players at that time?
I guess my question on that would be, how much advantage are you actually getting?
I agree.
I'm
with you.
But I think on this, I think that what's going to happen with this is we are going to see, again, on the showcase circuit and all, this is all the stuff that's coming up about year-round pitching and all. That's the part of the Dr. Andrews and Dr. Fleissig and all. That's the part of the approach, Eric Cressy and all that, that's new. I don't think
it's merely a reaction to what's happening.
But I'm saying as an industry, I don't think that the industry has had a chance. You know, the changes happen slowly. And maybe I put too much out that there's going to be, you know, the good of what's going to happen. But my expectation is that I think that that's going to happen organically. I think that organically what's going to end up happening is that there's going to largely, not entirely, but there's largely going to become essentially a 3 to 4 month gap in the schedule because we have all these experts coming out and saying, you need this layoff.
I really don't see that happening because there is a large profit motive that is behind these showcases.
But here's the thing. If you're a pitcher and you said, okay, your choices are
if the top pitchers don't go, JJ, then this is another opportunity for the pitchers a level below them to get exposure, to pitch in front of scouts, try to chase a college scholarship. I feel like some authority on top. The market is driving this. That's another reason why I don't believe in the market. But the market is what's driving this, and the market is not acting in the best interest of pitcher's health. So something else is going to have to act in the best interest of pitcher health. And it's not going to be, again, I'm picking on Perfect Game, it's not going to be the group that's building a multi-million dollar complex in northwest of Atlanta. Is it? Because they're motivated to have events at that complex, and that is their right. It's well within their rights, and their job is to make money, not to look out for the health of young pitchers in baseball. Really, right now, no one has that job, and no one's taking that job. I would say that that's a job that Major League Baseball, whoever the next commissioner is after Bud Selig, that would be, in my mind, job number two for that commissioner. Job number one for that commissioner is to make more money for the owners. Because that, if you don't do that, you're gone. So Bud Selig has grown this from $1 or $2 billion revenue industry to an $8 billion revenue industry. And so he's going to be universally lauded for doing a great job. But to me, the next commissioner, that would be a proactive thing for a commissioner of baseball to do, would be to try to take a holistic approach to, quote unquote, the game, capital G. And that would be one way to do that, in my mind, it is for Major League Baseball to try to get much more active in the amateur side of the game. And there are two ways that I think it can do that. Number one is trying to work with the NCAA to bring some sanity to college baseball schedule, which would be either maybe trying to push that back a little bit, if that's possible. Work with college baseball on having the draft not come during the college baseball season, so you could maybe move the draft back some in some way, so that you could also evaluate college players in some kind of, whether you want to call it a showcase, whether you want to call it a combine. I feel like Major League Baseball, I've talked to a lot of scouting directors over the last year who really want some kind of combine, some kind of medical combine, some kind of evaluation. You take your 200 top prospects, you're taking drug tests, eye vision tests for hitters, just interviews. Basic physicals, interviews, absolutely. Well, you do that in the summer when these kids are not in school. And I think if Major League Baseball was in charge of these showcases, and if to be a top prospect, to be considered one of the top, quote-unquote, 200 guys, you had to go to a Major League Baseball combine, I feel like that's something Major League Baseball should try to work toward. I don't go into that knowing that's easy, but that's something they should work toward and really take control, take the lead on that kind of thing, as opposed to leaving it to outside sources. I think you look at the NBA, that's been left, and college basketball, they've left it. They don't have any control over it, and that genie's out of that bottle for them. And the AAU travel basketball industry controls amateur basketball. And that has been to the negative effect of the NBA. I think MLB wants to avoid that example.
I think it's much more possible in the upcoming few years than it ever would have been before.
Right.
From the standpoint that the NCAA, as we know it, I mean, before the problem that we had before is that, okay, if you want to do the top 200 prospects, you want to do high school and college, you couldn't do it because they'd all have to pay their own way, and if they didn't, they would lose eligibility.
Right.
That may be going away. We may actually be to a reasonable area where you say, hey, there's nothing that affects your ability to play for a college, you know, by being paid, your travel being paid to a combine to work, to talk to teams. That doesn't in any way besmirch or hinder your ability to play for UCLA or Texas or LSU. Which, that's been the insanity that we've been dealing with for a long, long time.
No doubt.
The same way that, but they didn't, you know, something that never applied to me because I didn't participate in athletics. I could work any job I wanted in college.
Right.
You know, it wasn't something where, oh, I can't go there. It'll ruin my ability to go to my J school class next week. You know, nothing like that. But
you
so that
much of a ringer in a softball team?
Yeah, no, definitely not. But that could change. I think with all this, one thing I do want to point out for this, we talk about year-round and all that. I think that when we talk about why this huge uptick of injuries, I think that's a factor.
Yep.
I think, though...
It's not the only factor, sir.
But, I think in anyone searching for the factor, there is no the factor. I had one...
There's no magic loop.
Front office personnel, one guy put it to me this week, he said, I'm at the point where I'm almost trying to look at the healthy guys and what's common about them, because there's nothing common about all these different injuries. You can't find...
If Brandon Beachy and Chris Medlin were not travel ball guys, they were not guys who pitched a ton year-round. Chris Medlin was a junior college shortstop. Brandon Beachy was an NAIA third baseman. So, yeah, there are certainly a lot of outliers there.
But there's nothing that you can... I think the one thing that you can throw a blanket over this, and it's not entirely true on this even, but the largest blanket you can throw over it is that pitchers throw harder now.
Yep.
If you go back, the best data we have goes back to about 2000, good data, not the best, but good data goes back to 2002. 2002 to present, the average fastball in the big leagues has gone up about a mile to about a mile and a half an hour, okay? The average slider has gone up about a mile and a half an hour. The average every pitch pretty much has gained a tick. Okay? There's a lot more. It was in the last issue. We wrote a story about how there are, I think it's 26 high school pitchers from this class who've thrown 95 or above going into the draft. Okay, that doesn't mean they sit there.
Right.
But we have that many guys.
They've tickled it. They've touched it.
If you rewound that clock 10 years ago, and I know the guns are a little better and they may add a mile an hour. If you went back 10 years ago, you'd probably be talking about, in a draft any year, you'd be talking about 3 or 4. Guys are throwing harder. Doctor after doctor will point out to you, you can strengthen your muscles. That's one of the reasons they're throwing harder. Guys are better trained. They have a stronger core, all that. They have stronger shoulders. They've done all these things to throw, and so they throw harder.
They've trained for the possibility that they will be able to throw harder. And for many of them, it's come to fruition.
And you can strengthen the muscles to a small extent. You can lunge a little better, and they may add a mile an hour. If you went back 10 years ago, you'd probably be talking about, in a draft any year, you'd be talking about 3 or 4. Guys are throwing harder. Doctor after doctor will point out to you, you can strengthen your muscles. That's one of the reasons they're throwing harder. Guys are better trained. They have a stronger core, all that. They have stronger shoulders. They've done all these things to throw, and so they throw harder.
They've trained for the possibility that they will be able to throw harder. And for many of them, it's come to fruition.
And you can strengthen the muscles. To a small extent, you can strengthen a tendon. There is absolutely, positively nothing you can do to strengthen a ligament.
Yep.
There's no exercise. There's nothing you can do. And so what we're doing is the harder you throw, the more strain you put on ligaments. Now, I know we are still really, I've seen one study out there that looked at the guys who threw 100 miles an hour and said, hey, their TJ rate is about the same as everyone else. I think we still have to study that more. There's an awful lot of doctors and trainers I've talked to who their supposition, Dr. Andrews puts it at, he says that at 85 miles an hour, an 18-year-old, you're in the red zone. You're in the danger zone that this could cause a problem. Well, that means pretty much every pitcher who will be drafted in June out of high school is in the danger zone. Because if you're not throwing, if you're not throwing 85, you're not getting drafted.
Right.
There's no such thing as an 18-year-old getting drafted throwing 80.
You're hardly getting a Division I scholarship.
Right.
So if you're in that red zone, if you're in that red zone, you're also in the green zone. That's where you start getting paid and start getting scholarship money.
And the thing about it is that if I'm an agent, if I'm a coach, if I'm a player, even if you say, you know what, you're throwing 98, there's a decent chance that you may blow out your elbow at some point. The second thing I'd follow that up with is keep doing what you're doing.
Right.
You know why? Because if you want to succeed at what you do, I know we have a question we're going to answer here. And supposition of the question is that guys these days think that throwing hard is going to make you a better pitcher. Well, you know what? Because they're right. You can pull out any example you want. But the reality of it is that, yes, Greg Maddux was a great pitcher and he didn't throw all that hard for the majority of his success. I'll tell you right now, you can look at it any year, the harder you throw, the higher likelihood is you have a success.
Period.
That's not even...
It's not debatable.
I can tell you right now, we get this question. We've gotten this question. You've been at BA longer. I've been at BA for 12 years now.
Long enough.
12 years. Every year we get questions on guys, you got this right-hander who throws 88 to 90, or you got this lefty who throws 86 to 88, who's putting up great numbers in the minor leagues.
I mean, you're just saying over 85 is in the red zone. Here's Doug Mapson's report on Greg Maddux, May 26, 1984. He throws 86, 89 consistently with very good movement.
And by the way, he was 91, 92 at a, you know, when he was
as a
high school senior.
So he's in the red zone.
Right.
He was in the red zone.
But
how about this? I don't think I've seen a 10 curveball, but several pitches came about as close as you're ever going to get. So at that time, he wasn't even showing feel for spin. But then it says he has a big league CB. I think that must be changeup right now. He needs to be a little more consistent. Let's say it's curveball.
He's doing a 10 on the 2 to 8 on the positive side.
That's under weaknesses.
Oh, weaknesses. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we have CB and CB. We need to go back and edit our story from 1996, see what we got wrong there.
But my point is that we get this question every year. Hey, you're underrating this guy because he doesn't throw hard. You know, he doesn't have an average fastball, but he really knows how to locate. You can't find the amount of guys that you can find with a below average fastball when they reach the majors with long-term success, I'll give you every one of those. And you know what? Because for every guy you get right, I'll promise you, I can give you 10 more that you got that you missed on. Because right. if you, no one can succeed at the big league level by saying our inefficiency is that we are going to find guys who really know how to pitch with below average fastballs as young players. It doesn't work.
The Twins have tried that.
It doesn't work.
You know, they also had Joe Mauer. It worked to an extent, but it did not work for a World Series championship for them, and that's the goal.
And even their guys, when we go through their guys, the guys they had coming up had at least, in most cases, average fast. I mean, who are the guys? Slowey was
the... more average fastballs as opposed to below average. The right. Slowey, Blackburn...
But Blackburn was 90, would touch 95 when he came up.
Yeah, but it was mostly a 91 sinker baller. They just seemed like they had so many guys in that of that ilk at that time. Brian Dunsing, Glenn Perkins threw harder as a reliever, and he's stuck around as a closer. But like, Kyle Waldrop,
and we see guys every year. We'll see guys with below average to tick below average fastballs come up and have some success early on. Mike Fiers with the Brewers a couple of years ago.
Yeah, good example.
And you could go, wow, you know, did you guys miss on him? He's back in AAA. He's having a good year in AAA. But the margin of error, if you do not have an average to above average fastball, is very small.
I mean, like Dylan G. I think of Dylan G as a guy who doesn't throw terribly hard.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting around 90 with most fastballs, a decent amount that are below. But Dylan G to me is a...
Dylan G, and again... Dylan G,
back of the rotation.
You can find some 4 and 5s.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and he's a, you know, he
more
is.
Threes. All more threes, though. He's not a big four. He's not too many 4 or 5s on here.
No. I'm saying you could find a lot of 4 and 5 starters. You may be able to find a 4 and 5 starter. But again, velo is part of the game. And velo may, lead in some ways to elbow injuries. Now, the good news about this.
That's not going away.
The good news about this is, and we'll talk about this, there's, you know, we'll have stories coming out there, talk about this more. I think you can ask a very fair question about whether the pro approach, when it comes to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, if we're actually seeing any, the pro approach of, at the major league level, I think we have seen a definite benefit to the ending of the days of Nolan Ryan going out there and throwing 170-plus pitches and doing it again 4 days later. Nolan Ryan could handle that. A whole lot of guys couldn't.
Exactly. For every Ryan that we remember doing it, or Catfish Hunter, or whoever, there were 10 guys.
Frank Tanana was on that same staff with Nolan Ryan, and Frank Tanana's arm couldn't.
Right.
You know, and he threw really hard, and then he came back, and he threw really soft.
That's right.
You know, there are very few guys who can handle that. That's been good. What I think is a fairer question about whether or we're seeing a benefit is at the major league level, what that is, okay, we're not going to let you throw 130 almost ever. We're not going to let you tick past 120 that often. 100 to 110 is the sweet spot on a normal start.
Yeah.
That's where the baseball is as an industry as far as major leaguers. The minor league side, we've taken that and we've gone, okay, your first year, a lot of guys, we're going to let you go 75, and we'll eventually let you up to 90. You know, we'll let you throw 5 innings. You're not going to throw more than 5.
They count how many times you get up and down.
Right. All these things. Okay, the college approach, because colleges are trying to win.
Just another example. Yeah. We're here at Durham in AAA, and we see it year in and year out with an organization, the Rays, that has been as successful as anyone in the last decade at developing homegrown pitching. I know right now Hellickson, Cobb, and Matt Moore are all hurt. But the Rays are very consistent. They draft pitchers. They never send high school pitchers to full season ball in their first full year. They send them to extended and then short season. Maybe if you're a college guy, you can go. But if you're a high school guy like Moore, like Cobb, like Hellickson, you went to rookie ball.
Like Guerrero.
Then you went to New York Penn League. And then your third year, you went to full season ball. They do the same thing with most of their Latin American pitchers. And then they get to AAA, and I listen to a lot of the broadcasts. I've been part of that broadcast team. I've talked to Charlie Montoyo, who's been in that organization a long time. You know, 105 is about the max.
Mm-hmm.
And they use their bullpen every game. They expect to use two relievers basically every game. When
they have more.
When they have to use more, it is a real delicate balance. A lot of times those relievers, if they don't have a closer per se, because if Kirby Yates, for example, is closing in Durham and he gets called up to Tampa and he goes into the fifth inning of a game, he better be ready to get extended.
Mm-hmm.
He can't just be a one-inning guy in Durham. So all their pitchers in AAA fill all these different roles. They have to be prepared for every role. So it's a really difficult thing to manage a minor league bullpen, almost more so than a major league bullpen, JJ, because there's so many restrictions on those pitch counts, and there's very, very little flexibility with the roles those guys can play. Very little for the minor league manager.
But so at the minor league level, what the approach that has been done is that, okay, we're going to really work on keeping your innings down, especially when you're 18, 19.
That's just very challenging
to
do when you have baseball, a very unpredictable sport.
You're going to do that. We're going to keep your pitch counts very low. And by very low, I mean you're going to, in year two, year three, we will ramp you up to where you are allowed to tickle 100.
And this has been the case.
Sometimes.
And this has been the case for, in the industry, this has been the industry norm, it feels like, for about a decade.
I would say you could go back, if you go back to 2009, 2010, it was blanket.
Blanket.
I would say 2005, 2006, there were a lot of teams that did it, but I would say that at that level, I cannot promise you that it was 100% consistency.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember this, but the high-profile cases that stick out to me are a guy like Phil Hughes, who got the AA, the Yankees were good in 06. Phil Hughes was dealing. He was never allowed to go over five innings mm-hmm. by the end of that year. And he'd like have five no-hit innings with like 55 pitches out. You know, mm-hmm. I think I'm on the extreme low end of what his pitch count was. But he had extremely low pitch count. So you could be that efficient. Hey, the draft this year, Kyle Freeland just threw a 69-pitch, seven-inning complete game today. I mean, so you can be that efficient. But it's rare. Usually you had more cases like
four innings,
Tyone on these 75 pitch counts, and he couldn't get through five innings. He couldn't mm-hmm. get through four and change. Or Dylan Bundy, who was the best pitcher in that class on the high school side.
And in the first month of the season, he was allowed to go three innings, no more.
That's it. I mean, so you have real limitations
on
these guys.
So you have this. On the college side, it's been a different approach. They're trying to win. As the story was going to say, no minor league manager success of being long-term is wow, you win every year.
Hey, remember, it was Eric Bedard coming up. Will Lingo in the next room wrote this story. He might burst in. But Eric Bedard was going for a no-hitter in AA, and his manager and pitching coach let him do it. They burst past what the Orioles' limits were for pitch limits at that time. He finished the no-hitter, threw like 120-some pitches, got hurt, had Tommy John. Those guys, they gone. You know?
I mean, right.
And that was like when Eric Bedard was young. So this was like 10, 11, 12 years ago. So this is, the industry was trending that way a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. College level, so at the minor league level, your success, your long-term livelihood depends on developing players. And winning is a nice little secondary bonus. But if you keep producing, moving guys up to be big, quality big leaguers, and you win 45% of your games every year, you're still going to have a job.
Yeah.
You might end up being a field coordinator or a pitching coordinator, but right. you're going to have a job.
They prefer you to figure out a way to win
right.
with all these limitations.
But that is not the top priority. At the college level, winning is going to determine your long-term livelihood. You can produce first-round picks every year. If you don't win, you're going to be fired.
And let me tell you, the livelihood of a college coach is vastly superior to that of a
yes.
minor league coach or manager. And that's a fact, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, so it's another, I'm going on a tangent. Stop me if you heard this one before. The caliber of college baseball coach has gotten better and I think has improved at a greater rate than the quality of minor league coach or manager because the money is better in the college game. And if you can be a coach who both develops players and wins, you're going to get paid in college baseball. Kevin O'Sullivan at Florida is a great example. And Kevin O'Sullivan is making around $500,000 as the head baseball coach at the University of Florida.
And
there's no one not in the big leagues who's a coach who's making $500,000.
There's no minor league manager.
Farm directors, you know, the depots of the world, guys who are in charge of these departments, who are making $500,000. And so what is he able to do? He's able to go out and hire two pro scouts to go be his assistant coaches. And that happens more and more in college baseball. It just happened at the University of Cincinnati. Took an amateur scout from around here, Adam Barasa, hired him to be a recruiting coordinator. And Adam Barasa, I'm sure, is making more money and has a better quality of life being an assistant baseball coach at the University of Cincinnati. So this is the trend. The right. Money's better at the college level, especially at the bigger schools. So they're getting better and better personnel to coach. But Alan Dunn, another great example of a guy who was pro ball with the Cubs, now LSU's pitching coach. But if Alan Dunn doesn't win, if he doesn't help LSU win, he will lose that job.
So their approach is different. They're also on a seven-day rotation. As we talked about, they're not on a five-day. They're pitching every 7 days. The reality of it is that because of that, now, somewhat just because of the nature of how the game works, you do have a little bit of the same approach in that freshmen often throw less pitches because they have less trust. So unless you are excellent, like if you go back, when I was going through Kevin Gossman's pitch totals, you keep seeing Aaron Nola's name pop up because Gossman would leave the game and, oh, here comes Nola.
Yeah, Nola was a high-leverage freshman who was getting comped at that time to a mix of Jeremy Hellickson, LSU signee, and Lewis Coleman, LSU hero
now,
in 2009.
Now Kansas City Royal reliever.
Big leaguer, yeah, absolutely.
But so what you were seeing, so you do have somewhat, in most cases, of guys as freshmen, they have a lower workload, and then they ramp up as sophomores, and as juniors, they're the Friday starter. Well, the Friday starter, for most of the past 5 years, and let's be honest, I'm trying to research this, you go past 2010, and the data gets really hard to find. If you can find me Steven Strasburg's pitch counts by game for his junior year,
let us know.
Please let us know, because I've been working on it and I haven't found it.
John Manuel at baseballamerica.com.
But, and it's not just him. You go to 2009, it gets real hard to find him. But what we're seeing, though, is that at the college level, and for the majority of the past 5 years, your ace will throw 100 to 115 pitches after the first three or four starts of the year, most every time out, 100 to 115. And most guys, for a key game or two, they'll go to 120. You might see him go to 130. And that's pretty much, with a few exceptions, that's been, if you say 2010 to 13, look at the first round picks, that's been across the board. Now, Trevor Bauer goes into a separate category of his own. Trevor Bauer at UCLA threw more pitches, had a heavier workload on a 7-day schedule, let me say, but on a 7-day schedule, he had a heavier workload than any pitcher in the U.S., prominent pitcher. I'm not saying there's not some D2 guy.
Or Indy ball. Well, Hayden Simpson, JJ, one of the great missteps in the draft. I always contend that the once a week 130 pitches doesn't bother me as much as the 110 pitches on a Friday, and then you come back on a Tuesday, and then you come back on a next week. And Hayden Simpson was the big example of that. Did it in a regional, started on a Friday, came back on a Monday, 2 days rest. Or, of course, the prominent example we saw last year with Kent Emanuel, which I've said on the college podcast a million times. We don't know if Kent Emanuel got hurt because he hasn't broken down yet. He hasn't been cut on. He's pitching well in pro ball this year. But Kent Emanuel on short rest was extremely ineffective. Most of these guys on short rest in college baseball are extremely ineffective, which is one of the biggest reasons why you shouldn't bring a guy back on short rest. We will watch that this year. We have two prominent examples I tweeted about last night at the front of the first round this year. Carlos Rodon went 107 pitches, I believe it was, last Friday, with an hour and 15-minute rain delay stuck in the middle of that start. He will not be pushed up. The schedules move up at this time of year because you're preparing for a league conference tournament, which is another reason why conference tournaments should be abolished.
That really should be the thing. If you wanted to say, like,
get them out.
There's no purpose in that.
I hate saying that in a way, because the last 2 years, two of my favorite baseball memories were these NC State and North Carolina ACC tournament games, Rodon against the world. They've both been otherworldly games. They were two of the funnest games I've ever been to.
But that being said,
big picture, probably shouldn't have those games. But two things here. Rodon will not go on shorter rest this week. Even though they have a Thursday night game, NC State will use their Saturday tandem from last week, the game I did. Logan Jernigan threw 5 innings, Brad Stone threw 4. They're going to use those guys tonight in the Thursday game. Rodon will go on his usual rest on Friday. Contrast that with Evansville, who I already mentioned, Kyle Freeland coming off a 7-inning, 69-pitch shutout, will pitch on Thursday at Missouri State, and there is every likelihood that he will pitch on Tuesday in the first game of the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament, JJ, and that, to me, is in preparation for him being available for the championship game in the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament if needed. If Evansville thinks they need to win the conference tournament to get into NCAA regionals, now that is
where we start
getting into problematic territory, because there's some people who think that this guy has a reliever delivery, is the way it's been put. Which there's some recoil at the end. I get it. I don't see how you can say this guy has a reliever delivery when he's thrown about 100 innings and has 7 walks. He repeats. He repeats. The evidence is in the numbers. He does it, and he repeats. Does he do it as easy as, say, as Sean Newcomb? Does he do it as easy as some other pitchers do it? No. But he doesn't do it hard either. There's that little bit of recoil at the end, though. And one of the things you found, JJ, is that really it's just like the higher pitch count, the lower pitch counts in pro ball have not stopped elbow injuries. They have. There's data, not complete data, but there's evidence, I should say, that it has helped with shoulder injuries.
Right. That's the thing is if you said, if you're looking for the bright news of the dark era of Tommy John's that we were under, is that shoulder injuries, we're not seeing shoulder injury after shoulder injury. If you wanted to put a supposition out there, it would be that by reducing pitchers pitching fatigued, more than saving elbows, because as people put it, if pitch counts is supposed to save elbows,
we're not doing that.
There's only two answers you can give. One is that it's not doing it. Or two is that any benefit we're getting from the pitch counts of saving elbows, there are other factors that are overwhelming them. And that may be true. We don't know. That may be true. But when it comes to shoulders, we do not have the epic run. I'll throw it out there.
It's a very Socratic thing right now. I think I've given this credit to my fellow Greek Aristotle. But I believe it was Socrates who said that all we know is that we don't know, or all I know is I know nothing. With regard to these injuries, we don't know.
But who is the last, again, I'm putting you on the spot, and I'm trying to put myself on the spot too, the last top-end pitching prospect whose career was derailed a la Ryan Anderson by shoulder problems?
I'm thinking Chris Grueller.
Chris Grueller.
Didn't shoulder problems also happen with
Ty Howington?
Well, yeah, the Reds were in
the Reds. Place. Bobby Basham, I think, could be thrown into that.
Bobby Basham's scouting now, so maybe Bobby could let us know he sees a difference.
But, it used to.
Tim Stauffer. He recovered.
Danny Holson is the only. Danny Holson's the guy we don't know yet, but Danny Holson may be. It's a much smaller
subset of the shoulder subset is smaller than the elbows subset.
And that's good, because it's a lot harder to survive the shoulder injury than it is. The good news about this is it is crushingly bad news to hear that Jeff Hoffman and Eric Fetty are going to have TJ.
See, I would say it's bad news. I wouldn't say it's crushing, right, but because the industry seems to think, I just talked to a guy this morning, he said, I think that the Tommy John surgery is not the red flag it used to be. I actually think that the red flag is coming back up on that, because now we're basically seeing that if you have Tommy John once, you're more likely to need it again, maybe in 7 to 8 years. There might be a ticking clock on that, or if you're a Braves pitcher, in 2 years or immediately thereafter, which is very sad. I'm not saying that with any mirth.
But what I'm saying is it is sad, though, because I want, same with Jose Fernandez. Like everyone in baseball. If you love baseball,
you love Jose Fernandez.
The fact that Jose Fernandez,
unless you're Brian McCann.
But the fact that we're not going to get to watch him, it looks like, for another year. And when he comes back,
couldn't he maybe play first base for the Marlins?
But when he comes back, we may not see the same. Go back in our archives. We got every one of them archived. Look back at our podcast we did right after Steven Strasburg's first big league start. I talked about it in that podcast. Enjoy this as much as you can, because we may have seen Steven Strasburg in a way that we won't see him before long. And Steven Strasburg's great still.
But the difference, JJ, is that today, Jose Fernandez and Steven Strasburg, maybe that was fleeting, but they'll still be around and they'll still be good and they will time to time dazzle us. Maybe they won't be maybe we haven't seen Strasburg like he was that first game, and maybe that was just so special.
That was insane.
The best day ever in this office. I mean, probably the best day ever in this office, because we were all around the TV.
We were laughing. It was your birthday and Christmas and everything, and you got every present that you wanted, and it was all there in one little, you know, two hour
snippet. Yeah. It was, as Nathan Rohde would say, awesome. So, yeah, I lost my.
But they're going to keep.
But you know, a generation ago, though, JJ, you had Mark Fidrich do
two
that.
Generations ago now.
2 generations ago, 40 years ago, 38 years ago. But you had Mark Fidrich, and then it was gone. And when he got hurt, he gone. It was shoulder. It was everything with him, and he was done. And that was because of the way he was used.
Mm-hmm.
So the industry has done a better job of avoiding Mark Fidrich-like disasters.
And it's not just that the medical, because part of it is that the medical has improved.
Right.
But it's not just that. There is, in addition to that, the industry is avoiding some of those
smarter.
Things.
It's a smarter industry.
But I do think it is a fair question that teams to be asking. It can be difficult to buck this, but it's like, okay, what are we gaining? Are we actually gaining anything? And maybe I'm being heretical by throwing this out there, but the 75 pitch first, most of your first year, full year, are we gaining something from that? And I don't know if that answer is, again.
I don't think that's heretical at all.
I think there's a question. I'm not saying that we aren't gaining something as an industry from it, but I don't think we know we are.
Absolutely. I got draft calls to make, but I do want to wrap by reading this question from Reggie, longtime podcast listener and longtime contributor via emails, and just kind of wraps it all up. And he's just said he's concerned about the rash of pitching injuries. Young guys who have very solid mechanics going down, Matt Harvey, Jose Fernandez, list keeps growing. Is it the number of innings? Catfish Hunter, Fergie Jenkins, Nolan Ryan regularly threw 250 to 300 plus innings. Jack Morris approximated that in the 1980s. Not Hall of Famer Jack Morris, so doesn't really deserve to be in that same discussion with those other guys.
I thought he
did. Jack Morris did not make it.
Did not mean to say now Hall of Famer.
I said not Hall
of Famer. Oh, not
Hall of
Famer. I was like, no. I was like, yeah.
I'm saying he doesn't deserve really to be in the same conversation with these other guys. Were pitchers who threw a ton of innings pitching hurt and it wasn't known about? I doubt that. Is the problem nowadays that players are pitching from such a young age and they specialize too much mileage? Do we need to get back to the basic idea that velocity is not the key to success? And then his other questions he asks, is it in MLB's interest to study this with the NCAA, state schools, sports league, like the ones in Texas, create a database of all pitch players, innings, pitch counts, summer leagues, amateur leagues? Should there be a cap on this? I'm at a loss, but clearly something has changed between the time I was in grade school during the 80s and now. I think we've addressed a lot of that, JJ. It was one of the...
Yeah, but I mean, there's some good points I wanted. Like, yes. When he says, can you develop a database? Is it possible, theoretically, maybe? I'll tell you right now, you're not going to be able to develop a database of how many pitches guys throw.
And see, I think it is up to MLB to be proactive with all high school associations and to take that lead and invest the money that it takes in building that kind of information. Because I do think it feels like, JJ, the majority of MLB teams believe in data. They believe in information. You don't think they could...
No, I'm telling you, no. We can't even get it for at the minor league level yet. I mean,
I bet you major league teams have that information as
proprietary. But for their own team, they don't have it for everyone else. What I'm saying is if we don't even have it at that level, how are you going to ensure that at every high school? And look, I've covered small school high school baseball. You're lucky.
Right.
At a lot of these places, if you have someone who can actually tell you at the end of the game who drove in the runs, I can't tell you that you can find someone who is going to keep a semi, not even a fully, but a semi-accurate count of how many pitches each guy threw. I don't think, I mean, again, I'm not saying it wouldn't be a good idea. That's that. Okay, now let's go. How then you've got a centralized database so you know that this kid who pitched over there in high school is the same guy who's going over here as a 13-year-old and pitching, you know, he's on the freshman team here, and you're keeping track at the freshman level, too,
right,
to do this. And then he's going on his travel team on the weekends.
I don't think you'd have incontrovertible Major League Baseball caliber data. I do think if Major League Baseball took the lead on this, I do think you would have a lot more information if they made this a priority. I don't think you'd have 100% lockdown data. Right. But I think if you said, hey, parents, if your son pitches, here's where you can go on MajorLeagueBaseball.com, download this information for free, and here's how you keep track of your son's workload. I do think that if Major League Baseball took the lead on that, and if Major League Baseball helped run these showcases, and if the showcase circuit basically consisted of area code games and area code tryouts, East Coast showcase, and those kind of things that were run by scouts and not for profit, but for Major League Baseball to collectively control more of the development of amateur baseball, I do feel like you could make progress over a long period of time, I'm saying 5 to 10 years, in gathering a much more robust database. And I think that's realistic, and I think it has to be a priority for Major League Baseball.
Oh, sure.
Would it be a lockdown database? No, but that's not the world we live in.
Right.
But we could do a lot better than we're doing
now. But right now,
don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
But right now, the loophole that we have real issues with is that at the amateur level, we have a lot of rules in place. Little League Baseball has rules in place for how many pitches you can all throw. High schools have usage, you know, rules for pitchers in most, almost at this point, every high school federation.
The one thing,
the loophole, the issue we have is that, understandably, and maybe this is where, I don't know if MLB could do this or not, but the problem we have right now is that if you play on this team and this team in concurrent seasons, there is...
You mean like high school ball and then travel ball?
Right. Then you have real issues because, understandably, the high school federation has no real ability to control, to know. Your high school coach may not know how many, you know... If you're competitive enough, it's like you, the coach may not know, or the travel team coach may not know that you hit 7 innings on Tuesday.
Absolutely. No, they do know that. Yeah. I mean, like, you don't play travel ball at the same time as you're playing high school baseball. And I mean, so
At the lower levels, though, I'm not talking about high school, sorry. But you may be playing on your little league team and a travel team as a 13, 14 year old, and those two. You're going off here, you're playing here, and there are kids who are playing multiple teams at the same time, and or two different travel teams. There are kids who are playing, and you do not know.
This kind of the travel ball schedule is crazy because you run one tournament, and you realize, holy cow, this is very profitable. Let's have another. Because again, the only motive there is profit.
Mm-hmm.
They can say there are other motives, but the motive there is profit. Pure and simple, that's the American way. I get it. Major League Baseball has to get past that and look for other motives. The motivation for Major League Baseball has to be, how do we make our game at the big league level better? And that's why I think it needs to get more involved.
Again, I think the perfect...
I would advocate, if college baseball wanted to go to a 7-inning game, I'd have no problem with it. Zero problem with it. I think that would be a better thing for college baseball, personally, than having pitch limits, because the games do matter and winning does matter at that level, and that's something that I think is good and different about college baseball. But if you want to go to a 7-inning limit, I wouldn't have a huge problem with it. I don't think it would be the worst thing in the world for college baseball.
And to wrap up,
it would limit pitch counts.
To wrap up, I had people on Twitter, like, and again, I'm not saying I'm an expert by any way, but I've tried to talk to a lot of smart people about this in the last years, but we've been talking to people about this for years, but especially in the last couple of months with all the injuries going on. And the question I've been asked is, so if you had a kid in high school or whatever, you know, or 12 or whatever, what would you do? And I think there are some pretty simple things. But none of this, there's a lot of things that in moderation are good, but in excess are really bad. And okay, so if you got a kid who pitches, first thing is that there needs to be an off season. And correct. I mean, you have 4 months where absolutely. You say, I don't care. You aren't picking up a baseball. 4 months where you do not throw. Not that you're going to throw lightly. Not, you know, you have a period of time where you are, if you want to throw catch with your dad in the backyard where you're just throwing the ball from flat ground, you know, but beyond that, you're not getting on a mound for, there is a 4 month period where you're not touching a mound, you're not doing anything like that. You're not long tossing. You are.
See, I don't know about that. I mean, like, you need to rest, period. But 4 months is pretty locked down, and some people think that you just need to throw, JJ.
No, I know, but I buy the Eric Kresge argument on this, that the ligament needs time. And you know what, during that time? Go play another sport.
No, that's not a bad idea.
You know what? Shut down this. Go play. Pick your sport, but go play another sport, because the great thing about it is that you're not going to keep your athlete. You're going to add to your athleticism. If you play another sport, take your pick of what it is. If you play another sport, you're going to work muscles that you don't work. One of the issues we see here is we see a lot of pitchers who the description of them is that they're pretty stiff.
Right.
Why are they stiff? Because they've just been pitchers. If you're just a pitcher, you get really good. You are more advanced than the average 18-year-old at repeating your delivery, at throwing, you know, having velocity, all that. What you don't have with that, the more specialized you are, you get outside that comfort zone of that one thing you do, and you're generally, guys who would have been really good athletes have lost some of that athleticism. If you're playing other sports,
Just think of David Cone. You don't think of David Cone as some premier athlete, but he was a very athletic pitcher. And when David Cone needed a pitch, sometimes he made one up on the fly. And that takes athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes an athletic ability and a looseness and flexibility that not all these pitchers have. And especially the stiffness, to me, comes from overtraining. Whether it's too much weight training or where the emphasis is on just strength and not flexibility, and also overtraining, just doing the same actions over and over
right.
again and kind of getting in a rut.
I think some of that stiffness, though, is not just like being muscle-bound at all. It's also just, if you don't ask your body to do things, it doesn't learn how to do them.
Right.
And that's where, if it's basketball or it's soccer or whatever, if you're playing basketball in addition to playing baseball, you're going to force your body to do things on the basketball court that you would never ask it to do playing baseball. Not all of that's going to translate over, but it is going to, some of it is.
Right. I mean, there's a level of athleticism that's needed in pitching that guys lose when all they do is pitch. So. Mm-hmm.
The same way that if you're a two-way guy, you know, you keep some of that athleticism. There's a reason. The best way I can explain this to you is there's a reason that guys who were two-way guys in high school or even two-way guys in college, pitchers get to the big leagues and they're not very good hitters. Why is that? If you don't work on something, you lose it.
Exactly.
And
whether you're Tim Hudson or Sean Markham or whoever.
You lose some of that. In most cases, if you're not working on something, you lose some of that athleticism.
JJ, this was fun.
It was.
I'm trying to look up Carlos Rodon's hitting stats. They're pretty good this year. He's 13 for 42. So, hitting .310. With these bats, that's pretty good. So, he's still using it. He doesn't take as much beeps as he used to, though. He's trying to focus on pitching, so the batting practice stuff. It's funny. I'll wrap on this. And there's so much criticism of his workload this year. You know, his freshman year, he pitched on 3 days rest the first couple weeks of the year, and it was just in short bursts, 50, 60 pitches. They ramped him up toward pitching in their rotation. And then don't forget his freshman year, his super regional start against Florida was rained out after 3-4 innings. And he was not brought back after a longish rain delay. And then he did not come back the next day, and they got eliminated in 2 games. And that team had not been to the College Series at that time since 1967. And they used him pretty properly. He's a big boy. He's been...
My thing is, he has given us
no indication that he's been overused. The quality of his stuff keeps getting better as the course of the year goes on. And his 131st pitch in one game of 132 was 95 miles an hour. So,
if you want to have concerns about his workload, I understand it for a couple things. One, unlike most of these guys, he was prominent as a freshman. As another, he throws a lot of sliders.
That's the issue. That's always been the issue.
That, he throws a lot of sliders. There are a lot of guys we can think of who they left their best stuff in their early years because they were slider heavy. I mean, it's a tough pitch to throw. That all being said, and again, yes, he's been worked hard this year. He was worked hard last year. He was worked hard the year before that. That being said, we do not know. Again, if you want to say that you have concerns about it, I understand it.
Right.
If you say you know, I'm telling no, you don't know, because we don't know. Trevor Bauer was worked harder than him, and maybe Trevor Bauer is an outlier. Trevor Bauer averaged 128 pitches a start his junior year.
Yeah.
He topped 130 regularly. He went top 120 11 times that year.
That's
great. And he may blow out tomorrow. Trevor Bauer, right as of right now, has made every start that his pro team has asked him to make.
And he was...
He's never had to stay on the DL.
He was prepared for that. That's what he trained to do.
And again, that doesn't mean that I think that every pitcher should go out there and throw 130 pitches every start.
And some of them can't. I mean, Tyler Beede can't get past 8 innings. He's gone 8 innings once in his 3-year college career. Once. So some guys can't do it. And I think Tyler Beede's physically capable of doing it. He just doesn't. He's just not pitch efficient enough. So.
Well, and also, Vanderbilt's a team that, if he was at...
You can't say that. Sonny Gray, 125 pitches, went back out for the 8th.
I'm not saying there are exceptions. You didn't let me finish. I'm saying Vanderbilt's a team that, as a general rule, their guys throw a few less pitches than, say, a team like NC State. Now, look back. If you look at...
I think that's probably not true, because NC State hasn't had other pitchers good enough to go deep in games.
What I'm saying is that if you compare... Sonny Gray, I went back and looked at the pitch counts.
Sonny Gray is like half Carlos's size.
Right. Vanderbilt does not have a pitcher. I will stand by it. Vanderbilt does not have a pitcher who regularly goes 120 plus. I'm not saying they haven't had guys.
That's correct.
If you say Florida never has a guy go 120.
That is correct. And Florida has a guy.
And I'm not saying, again,
pick who got hurt in Carsten Whitson, who blew out his shoulder. It is just not.
Well, he's had shoulder injuries. We don't even know.
He's a shell of his former
self. Right, I'm not saying
He's had surgery.
He
missed all of last year.
No, I know he had surgery, but didn't the doctor say that they couldn't find anything?
No. He missed an entire year with shoulder surgery. It was significant. Yeah. And he's in the low 90s now, and he's never thrown more than 98 pitches previous to that in his Florida career. And he started on senior day, and he didn't last one inning. And Vanderbilt put up a 16 spot in that game. Every college program, with the exception of Florida, has some pitch count hickeys that you can point to.
Oh, I'm not saying they don't.
Tyler Beede's had 30-plus pitch innings, too. I would point to Tyler Beede as a ding on Vanderbilt, because I've talked to scouts about it, and I would point to Sonny Gray's end-of-season usage that year. Vanderbilt's bullpen, which used to be expansive, shriveled up. And, hey, Grayson Garvin's another guy, SEC Pitcher of the Year, didn't pitch for a year and a half after that in Pro Bowl. I'm just saying. NC State has not. I'm not trying to defend.
I was going to say, but you're actually saying that I'm saying something I didn't say.
No, I'm saying that NC State's never had a pitcher good enough for us to know whether they would do what they've done with Carlos Rodon to other pitchers. They haven't had anybody good enough in the last 10 years.
I disagree with you on that. I went back, look back at Jake Buchanan's pitch counts. They're higher than Sonny Gray's. Yeah, not as good, but they were higher.
I'm not disagreeing with that, but Jake Buchanan, well, Corey Bazzoni, let's go back. Corey Bazzoni was a guy with stuff. Jake Buchanan's an 88, 91, 92 guy, always was.
No, I'm not saying he wasn't.
I don't think you can compare him to Sonny Gray.
No, what I'm saying is I think I can. I'm saying that NC State's pitchers, if they're in any way a front end of the starter, they generally throw more pitches than a Vanderbilt front end starter. That's simple.
That is true. But when push comes to shove...
Oh, I'm not saying they're not.
That's all I'm saying. But I'm saying that no one's blameless in this in college
baseball. I'm not casting blame. I'm saying that what I'm just saying is that there are teams that will let their guys go more pitches than other teams. As I'm going through this, I can see teams, and it's pitch, you know, if they've had multiple guys, and you go, okay, their general comfort level is that their guys go 90 to 110.
But I understand that, but the point of that is what?
Oh, I'm
what
not even.
What is the end point of that?
No, I'm just saying that teams have different teams have different comfort levels as far as where they think that.
Correct, but when push comes to shove, everybody but Florida and the minor leagues, everybody in North American baseball that I can think of, besides the minor leagues and the University of Florida, when push comes to shove and they need to win, will extend a pitcher. Everybody. So I'm saying that point of Vanderbilt in general is a pointless point. There isn't a great point to that. Because when push comes to shove and they need to win, they will extend a pitcher.
But again, you're trying to put a point here that I'm not...
I'm trying to figure out what your point is.
My point is that Vanderbilt's comfort level as normal for what their guy goes is less than some other teams.
But to what end? That's what I'm wondering.
What I'm saying is that in 12 or 13 of that guy starts, he's going to throw less.
I'm not disputing the facts.
But you're trying to. I'm saying that's the point I had. All the point I was making was that NC State's pitchers, their ace, on a normal Friday night is going to throw more pitches.
He's treated more like a college guy, whereas Vanderbilt's treated more like a pro guy.
Right. And I'm not saying, again, I don't have David Price's pitch by unit.
I'm wondering which is better.
I've said on this podcast, I don't think we have the data to say that the Vanderbilt or the Florida approach keeps guys healthier.
That's all I'm saying.
Right. I'm saying that different schools approach it differently, and I'm following that up by saying if you can,
because Vanderbilt is held up to this right. In this esteem, and David Price came back on 2 days rest in the 2007 regional, gave up the home run that kept had them lose to Michigan, Allen Oaks in that regional, and Sonny Gray extended it the one time they went to Omaha. Vanderbilt is held up, and I'm not knocking Vanderbilt. I respect the hell out of Vanderbilt. But they are held up as this paragon of virtue, and I don't believe they deserve that credit.
Vanderbilt's
the wrong example to use for me.
All I'm saying is that I do not think that there is data out there to say that because I do think it's a different approach, but that the Florida, which is the strict, or the Vanderbilt, which is the strict with exceptions to the lower pitch count approach. Don't think that you can say at the college level right now, and I'm still studying it, I haven't finished the story, but I don't think you can say, you can point to it and say, that's worked better for long-term development than the UCLA approach, where they had Garrett Cole and Trevor Bauer in the same rotation,
and they used who
they used to a higher level of workload.
I'll tell you this. I'll just say again, so all the attention was on North Carolina last year, negatively, with good reason. Vanderbilt did basically the same thing with David Price. They essentially did the same thing with, I will note, the same, actually a worse result. Yeah, Ken Emanuel got hit, but North Carolina won its regional against a Southern team, a Florida team, an FAU. Vanderbilt, an SEC team, lost its regional to a Big Ten team. So let's just... And so you're talking about, we're looking at data 2010 plus, that was 2007. So we're just, that's why, I'm sensitive to it, because we have such a what have you done for me lately. Vanderbilt has this reputation. I'm not knocking them, but they're not this paragon of virtue. And if there was one pitching coach, if you asked me about it, you started this whole thing with son, who would I want my son to play for? Johnny Savage. UCLA. I know that'd be 3,000 miles away, and that would stink, but... One college coach he'd play for, John Savage. Period.
Well, why is that?
And guess what? Well, number one, because I met him in 1998, and USC's my all-time, USC 98, all-time favorite college baseball team. He was the pitching coach for that guy, but he was also the pitching coach for Mark Pryor. He was the pitching coach for all these UCLA guys. And guess what? UCLA produced a lot more pros under Gary Adam with his roll the balls out. That was the criticism. And John is certainly not, he certainly manages more on the college tip, but I think he takes care of pitchers' health. I think he manages pitchers extremely well. I think he has a long track record of doing that. And he's also won a national championship. So Vanderbilt does a great job of that, has been to Omaha once, and you can find, you have high workloads for Cole and Bauer. They were prepared to do those things. Vanderbilt did not prepare their pitchers to do that. And then they got to Omaha, and here comes Sonny Gray having to throw more. I have more of a problem with someone taking a pitcher outside their comfort zone, asking them to do something they've never done before on the biggest stage, than I do with Garrett Cole. We've trained you. We've built you up to throw 100, 110, 120. Garrett Cole was used to it. Trevor Bauer was used to it. I think that's the much better approach than to all of a sudden you've never gone more than 125 pitches and all of a sudden in Omaha in the eighth inning we're doing it. So I am sensitive to the Vanderbilt thing because I think that because of a lot of positive media attention, they get more credit than they deserve. So I respect DJ. I respect Tim Corbin to the highest degree. And I know Tim Corbin and John Savage are tight. I remember Mark Pryor talking about showing up at the weight room in the Netherlands in 2000 with the college national team, and Savage and Corbin had beaten him to the workroom. And the next morning, he beat them. They were there at 5:30. That meant he was there the next morning at 5:00. So I know that Corbin and Savage are similar in those regards. No one's perfect, but to me, the best track records of college baseball pitching development, to me, is John Savage. And everybody else falls in line behind. So I thought it was great for college baseball. And for pitcher development, that John Savage won a national championship last year, because I think his way is the best way. Because he expects a lot of his pitchers. He does not abuse them, but he expects a lot out of them. And for the most part, they deliver.
And one other thing they do is it's a fastball-based approach.
A lot of them, but Trevor Bauer did not fill up the zone with fastballs. He threw six pitches or seven, and he threw too many of the other ones. But JJ, I think you get in, you get out of it what you put into it. So if you, I think we baby pitchers in general. I think that I'm not a fan of the 75 to 90 pitch thing at all.
No, at all. You're not. I'm much more.
Pitchers pitch.
Right.
This started with the 4 months off. I don't think that's right for everybody. I would let someone like Eric Cressy look at. I think that someone like Eric Cressy would look at what a pitcher's workload has been during the year.
No, well, he says, the thing he says is, and I think there's some logic to this, is that the ligament stretches while you pitch. The ligament actually shrinks back during that off time. Now, again, and his emphasis is that doesn't mean sit on the couch.
Right.
But that does mean, he says, I want time. You regain stability in the ligament during that off time. And there's, and again, I'm not smart enough to understand that.
I would guess that Eric Cressy would throw that out for most pitchers, but that he would, that there's always flexibility, because when I read that at Q&A, it seemed like he was a guy who was going to work very specifically, and that he wants pitchers to work specifically with their trainers, and that there are always exceptions to anything like that. But 4 months off is a long time off.
3 to 4 is, and that's Dr. Andrews too. Dr. Andrews is, you know, which that again,
you could probably work in a long toss every once in a while.
But you know, I mean, and we have different, you know, we both are very interested in this.
We don't have the data to know which of us is right on that.
We're not even. I'll go a step further. Neither of us have the medical background to know, which is all we can do on that. On some of this, I don't understand the ligament enough to be able to speak with, you know, I have to take, I'm passing it along.
Journalists aren't pretending to be experts, JJ, so they're having informed opinions, so you don't have to make that qualifier. But we've talked to a lot of people, and there are a lot of people in the game who aren't doctors either, but they're making these decisions, have to make informed decisions. And what I do hope is that at the bigger level, that we start to see that this 3 or 4 year trend, we start to see the game trying to make more holistic, more general decisions that are not short-sighted. Let's get this pitcher healthy with surgery. Let's try to think of things as an industry. We're not part of that industry, but we're observers of the industry.
But we are.
We're see people in the industry.
And in some ways we are too, that we're at a baseball magazine. We want baseball to succeed. If baseball succeeds, our magazine does well. If baseball fails, you know, if baseball becomes tennis, we're in trouble.
Yeah, if baseball becomes boxing, we're in trouble. Absolutely. So we would like to see the game figure out answers to these problems, to these questions. So, all right, JJ, good stuff. You finally brought it out of me in the last 20 minutes. So hope everybody listened to the whole thing. It's the longest podcast. We haven't done one of those in a while. Don't forget Baseball America's draft offer. Subscribe now and receive one extra month of access with any premium content subscription. BaseballAmerica.com/subscribe to order. For JJ Cooper, he's at JJCoop36. I'm at John Manuel BA. We'll talk to you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.
Guns are a little better, and they may add a mile an hour. If you went back 10 years ago, you'd probably be talking about, in a draft any year, you'd be talking about 3 or 4. Guys are throwing harder.